And now in a moment, our conversation today about Southeast Asia terror groups. Zachary Abuza says they're winning, those groups, in countries like Thailand. But first, what Congress failed to do, Homeland Security is about to. Strict new immigration rules are expected to go into effect any day now. They would force businesses to fire employees whose Social Security numbers don't match up with federal records. Employers face fines or up to $10,000 per worker for not complying. Word that the new regulation is about to kick in has triggered concerns about labor shortages around the country and in some cases protests. But supporters of the new rules say they're designed to crack down on the country's estimated 12 million illegal immigrants. Well, Antonio Olivo is covering the story for the Chicago Tribune. Antonio, employers have been notified by these so-called no-match letters, which tell them the information that employees gave to the company doesn't match the government records. But the government has sent out these letters since the 1990s, so underscore this. What's the big change now?
The big change is that the federal government is imposing tougher rules with regards to no-match letters.
Are they expected to make some sort of announcement about them?
They will make an announcement. When that will happen is anyone's guess at this point. They're not saying when this will go into effect. There's speculation that it will happen sometime this month, though.
What else does the no-match letter say the employers have to do?
Well, the employers have to first check for clerical errors to make sure that somebody's name isn't misspelled or a recently married woman isn't mistakenly using her maiden name when her husband's name is now on government records. Once that's done, they will have workers bring in additional documents to prove their identities. That will mean birth certificates, green cards, anything basically that doesn't have a Social Security number on it.
Right. And if they can't prove that, then the employers have to fire the employees.
That's where it gets really tricky for employers. They either have to fire the employees or face the risk of fines as much as $10,000 per worker, and that's where a lot of the blowback is coming.
Well, we understand the employers are being told they have 63 days to do this whole process, and they're saying they're negotiating for more because they're saying that often, as you said, the records aren't accurate. Isn't that a problem? Because the Social Security Administration told the New York Times that 140,000 of these so-called no-match letters are going to go to employers, covering more than 8 million workers. Let's say that even over a fraction of those are challenged by the companies as inaccuracies. Will the government be able to handle those challenges in 63 days?
That's the big question, and it's not just Social Security. It's also the arm of DHS that administers immigrant applications. They'll have a role in this as well, and their records don't sync with Social Security. Social Security's records aren't essentially completely accurate, so that's where a lot of the concern is. And DHS has indicated that they may put in additional time for appeals. A worker who essentially is saying, I do have all my information, I just need more time. Right. There will be special windows of time for that.
Well, meantime, Antonio, some workers are taking preemptive action. In your area, workers from Dunkin' Donuts are protesting and filing a class action suit. They're now, you know, alleging labor abuses. And at a soap factory, workers have apparently also been on notice. Tell us, you know, briefly what the strategy is there.
First, historically, these letters haven't been really paid much attention to by a lot of employers who rely on, let's face it, illegal immigrant labor to get their jobs done. So now the attitude is, if you're going to tell on us, employer, then we'll tell on you and we'll tell about these labor violations that we've been suffering through for all these years.
Right. So Dunkin' Donuts, they're protesting outside the Dunkin' Donuts, saying that they're forced to work long hours. As we said, they're filing a suit. What's happening at the soap factory?
At the soap factory, it's interesting. That company was recently bought by another company. New management came in. They noticed all these no-match letters that had been ignored for a few years, decided to act on them. That stirred a panic in the workplace, and most of the workers walked off the job. They weren't going to be fired by their boss, the company says, but since they walked off their job, that is a fireable offense, and now they are in the process of being fired. And so they're trying to unionize there and fight that battle.
You quote one worker saying, we may not win, but if we don't have papers, we're not going to stay quiet.
That's definitely the attitude here in Chicago. It's a pretty active community. Major marches have taken place and a lot of mini rallies in between. They don't stay quiet here in Chicago, at least.
Well, we understand there's concern that there's going to be widespread labor shortages, but what are other concerns if undocumented workers are simply fired?
There's already a pretty healthy market for stolen Social Security numbers, for fake birth certificates. The argument is essentially that if you get fired today, you go to the black market, get another identity, and find a job somewhere else. Companies may put their workers off the books and not report essentially what is tax information to the federal government, and then you'll just have a broader underground market of workers.
Antonio Olivo covers immigration issues for the Chicago Tribune. He's been speaking to us about tough new federal rules expected to go into effect as early as this week that would severely punish companies for failing to fire workers using someone else's Social Security numbers. Antonio, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
To an area we haven't covered that much lately, the National Intelligence Estimate released last month concluded that a resurgent al-Qaeda based in Pakistan on the Afghan border is as strong as it was before it launched the 9/11 attacks. We remember that report, and the current heated debate, at least among Democratic candidates for president, is whether or not to bomb Pakistan if its leaders can't root out the insurgents there. But while many eyes have been focused on that part of the world, our guest today has been studying another region that he has long called the Crucible of Terror. Zachary Abuza is professor of Southeast Asian politics and security issues at Simmons College here in the Boston area. He's the author of many books, including Militant Islam in Southeast Asia and the forthcoming Conspiracy of Silence, the Insurgency in Southern Thailand and its Implications for Southeast Asian Security. He's been a frequent guest on the program, and he joins us now. Zach, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Literally welcome back, because you've just gotten back from the region. And as we said, we haven't really looked this way in a while. You put Southeast Asia on the map in this way as a hotspot for Islamic militancy. It's a very complicated picture, but just can you give us the umbrella thought at the start?
It is complicated right now because there are so many different organizations out there, and some have suffered considerably in the past few years from government actions, but some are increasingly growing and their capabilities are getting stronger. But I think probably they're benefiting from the fact that the world's attention is not on Southeast Asia right now. It's on Iraq and other parts.
Well, there's growing violence in Thailand. We'll talk about that. Terror networks spreading in places like Singapore, Malaysia, bombings in Mindanao in the Philippines, the group Jamaah Islamiyah's new lease on life in Indonesia. Just to give us an idea, it's a growing Islamist movement. Why do you see an uptick? What are you reading where you see this uptick?
Well, I think you have to disaggregate it. I mean, at the one hand, you have Islamist political parties and movements that are growing in strength in all of those countries. And then you have the militant jihadist groups. In Indonesia or Malaysia, the Islamist parties are growing, but the militants have taken hits in the past few years. In Thailand, you have a growing insurgency. And in southern Philippines, again, a very complex picture. You've got three different militant organizations. They're growing because they have some very legitimate grievances. They're growing because of dissatisfaction with America and their governments.
Well, I also meant, how do you, graph that they're growing? I mean, what are some of the things that tell you that they're changing or morphing?
Well, you can look at simple incidents. In southern Thailand, there in the past 3.5 years, there have been about 6,000 incidents of about 2,400 people killed. You can look at upticks in ceasefire violations in the southern Philippines. You can look at an increase in sectarian violence in Indonesia's outer islands.
And a brutal violence. Let's stay with Thailand. You write, the conflict in southern Thailand dwarfs any other in Southeast Asia. It deserves far greater attention. Let's remind ourselves, Thailand underwent a coup almost a year ago. The general who took over is now, his government is having this conflict with the Islamic rebel groups in the south. Thailand, a majority Buddhist country in the south, a Muslim majority. And when you say an uptick in violence, it seems as if, you write about attacks on school children, for instance.
Oh, there have been a lot of attacks. Like the Taliban in Afghanistan, one of the things that the insurgents have done in southern Thailand is go after teachers and schools. More than 225 schools have been arsoned. About 80 teachers in the past few years have been gunned down.
Children beheaded?
Thailand have children been beheaded. In Indonesia, there were some groups that beheaded, one group that beheaded three schoolgirls. But in Thailand, there have been about 35 beheadings. Recently, they've been burning corpses of people they kill and desecrating the corpses. So
you also
it's very
write,
grisly.
You write about more sophisticated bomb techniques as well.
Absolutely. This average kilogram size of IEDs in southern Thailand has gone from 1 or 2 kilograms about 4 years ago to 15 to 20 today. It's not unusual to have armored Humvees blown across the road.
These are the explosive devices.
Right.
Well, you were starting to mention some of the reasons why, you know, what's behind this insurgency. What is behind it? Because you've also written in the past that many of the little middle class Thais, for instance, there's a complacency in Thailand, and that many, even the intellectuals, think, oh, this is about poverty and social justice. Is it?
It's not. I mean, the deep south of Thailand is not the poorest part of the country by every means. Places like the northeast are poorer by every measure of human development. In the south, it is about identity. It's about cultural survival, and it's about grievances. It's about linguistic rights.
They like to have their language brought back?
Yep, absolutely. But this is a secessionist movement, and it's not new to Thailand. They've had an ongoing secessionist rebellion for about 100 years, but I make the case that the current manifestation is fundamentally different.
Well, and you take that point and make it broader across the entire region, that there's a new kind of self-conscious Islamic identity, even if the conflicts are local, as we've been saying, local causes, local grievances. People see themselves as part of this international Islamic struggle. But I want to just ask you about that, because is this then a legitimate sort of clash of civilizations, or, as we saw in one of the last stories I think we talked to you about, we remember, for instance, the beheading of a kidnapped American missionary by an insurgent leader who was, you know, barely a practicing Muslim. In fact, he was more a practicing pirate.
Yeah.
So how much is a true, you know, sort of religious war, and how much is thuggery?
There's a lot of thuggery. I can't even begin to deny that. There is growing Islamic identification across Southeast Asia, and people who have been following this region are kind of shocked by the degree that this Islam in Southeast Asia, which is traditionally very moderate, syncretic, works very compatibly with religious minorities in the region, is now increasingly more fundamental, more orthodox, less tolerant of minorities. You're getting the creeping Salafism into the region.
Hmm. Well, when we come back, we're going to take a break in just a moment. And when we come back, we want to ask you, do you think Thailand is going to split in half because of this increased insurgency in its south? We're talking with Zachary Abuza, professor of political science at Simmons College here in Boston, also author of many books. We'll throw one in, Militant Islam in Southeast Asia. We'll have much more from Zachary. And later in the program, don't forget, the ethical questions surrounding the treatment of brain damaged patients. We're going to speak with ethicist Arthur Kaplan because of a couple of big news stories. The case of the near-coma patient who had electrodes placed in his brain and he came back to life, or the doctor accused of hastening death in order to harvest organs. That's later in the program as well. Back after a minute break, here and now. And now, earlier this summer, the National Intelligence Estimate stated that al-Qaeda was back in its pre-9/11 strength. It had found refuge in a tribal region of Pakistan, a sort of no-man's land along the border with Afghanistan. Today, we're looking beyond Pakistan to the terrorist organizations that are up and running and thriving in the Philippines, Indonesia, Thailand. We're speaking with Zachary Abuza, a professor of Southeast Asian politics and security issues at Simmons College here in Boston, recognized internationally as an expert in this area. And Zachary, I'd asked you just before the break if you thought Thailand was going to split up. Before that, we keep speaking of al-Qaeda's insurgents. Do you see the insurgency in the south of Thailand and the complacency in the north, but do you see the insurgency in the south as tied to al-Qaeda, fueled by al-Qaeda?
There's no evidence that al-Qaeda is actually running it, or even Jemaah Islamiyah is involved in running it. It certainly could inspire them. The Thai police and army have found al-Qaeda documents, bomb-making manuals, etc., in madrasas and camps they've overrun, but that's the extent of it.
Well, and what do you think is going to be the result of it? Do you think Thailand's going to break up?
I don't think they're going to break up right away. The insurgents have clearly gained a lot of momentum in the past 4 years simply because the Thais have mishandled it so poorly. But it's still, while it's a very violent movement, it's still a fairly elite movement. It's not a mass-based movement. I'm very concerned that the longer that this gets drawn out, the more you reach that tipping point in which people will begin to side with the insurgents simply because they at least can provide security and social services that the government is not. But I don't see them succeeding anytime soon.
Well, you mentioned providing social services. Let's look at other countries in the area, the largest being Indonesia, with the world's largest Muslim population. You mentioned their very active radical Islamic group, the Jamaah Islamiyah. They were involved in the Bali bombings and are actually, you know, have ties with al-Qaeda. You've been following them closely, but you say they're changing their strategy. Describe that change.
They've taken real hits in the past 3-4 years. Almost 500 personnel have been arrested around the region. They have not been able to perpetrate a terrorist bombing for almost 2 years now. So what you're seeing is JI going above ground.
JI is Jamaah Islamiyah.
Right. To use the mafia slang, they're trying to go legit. And they realize that right now it's actually counterproductive to be a terrorist. Forcing the governments of the region to crack down on them. Their operatives are being arrested. It's setting the whole agenda back. And so what you see right now is the focus on religious education, proselytization, and now groups and subgroups affiliated with JI are involved in the provision of social services. And they're adopting what I would call a Hamas model in Southeast Asia that they've never were engaged in before.
Whereas some of the other insurgent groups, and there are so many in this region, are taking the other tactic of terrorizing people in the hopes of driving them away from the more secular schools and things. And, you know, if you go to a secular school, we're going to attack the kids in the school, and and then you will know to go to a madrasa or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You see that in parts of the outer islands of Indonesia, or you see it in southern Thailand. But right now, JI is really in a rebuilding mode. They're trying to recruit a new generation. And what they're also really trying to do is win political support. And the heart of this is this social welfare campaign that they've been doing since late 2004.
Well, in the meantime, running parallel to that, I mean, most would say that Indonesia would seem to be a more hopeful country right now, a working democracy, maybe the only Muslim democracy in the world.
Indonesia's transition to democracy is nothing short of spectacular, and they deserve amount of credit for what they've done in a short period of time with a limited amount of violence.
But we mentioned other countries we don't have time for now, Malaysia, other countries financing networks, and you're raising a red flag. So given that, what should happen? First of all, what role should the U.S. play? We've already seen how disastrous it can be when the U.S. is perceived as fighting a holy war against Muslims.
In the southern Philippines, the Americans have played a very good role. They have a presence there of less than 500 men. They're engaged in the sharing of intelligence and training of the Philippine armed forces. And it's helped professionalize them. I think they've had some real successes in the past year against the Abu Sayyaf. The Americans have done some very good hearts and minds stuff with a U.S. Naval hospital ship, the Mercy, which has come to the Philippines. It was providing tsunami relief in Indonesia. Those types of things are very important.
It sounds as if you're saying that the methods of truly winning hearts and minds and not as much as possible pulling out weapons, giving the residents something else to choose besides the
insurgents. Development is very important in all this. And I don't believe that terrorism is caused by poverty, but certainly it is a catalyst.
Yeah. But what can the countries do?
Well, I think the governments are doing a very good job in terms of going after JI, which is they're not going using heavy-handed military tactics. It's been much more surgical. I think a lot of people were concerned that there are going to be egregious human rights abuses coming out of this mass arrest, and there haven't been. I mean, if you consider that there have been 500 arrests in four countries around the region, it's been you know, fairly surgical what they've done. There's an attempt in many of these countries to rehabilitate the JI members. So I think that's been very important. They focused on police and intelligence rather than a military response. But they have to understand that these people have a very long-term agenda and will go underground.
Zachary Abuza, he's a professor at Simmons College in Boston, author of many books on Southeast Asia, including the forthcoming Conspiracy of Silence, the Insurgency in Southern Thailand, and its Implications for Southeast Asian Security. Just a few seconds. Conspiracy of Silence. Among who?
The reason I titled the book is that no group has publicly claimed responsibility for the attacks in Thailand. And they're using the silence as to leverage or amplify the mysterious aura of them. And they're not coming out and saying, this is what we want, this is what we need. A lot of people dismiss them for saying, oh, it's nihilistic. But no, there's a lot more organization behind it.
Zach, thanks as always for redirecting our gaze. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Well, still ahead today, some ethical questions about the treatment of brain damage patients. That's after the news, here and now. Support now, and today we have a look at ethics and medicine through the lens of two stories in the news. First, an unprecedented criminal case is unfolding in California. It all comes down to what happened the night of February 3rd in an operating room at the Sierra Vista Medical Center in San Luis Obispo. What is not in doubt is that 33-year-old transplant surgeon Hutan Ruzrock and a colleague were in the operating room working for a regional group that procures organs. Next week, he'll answer to charges that while there, he administered massive amounts of drugs to hasten the death of a brain-damaged patient in order to harvest his organs. The treatment of brain-damaged patients is also in the news because of surgery that has revived a man in a 6-year near coma. He had electrodes planted in his brain. Well, joining us on the line is medical ethicist Arthur Kaplan, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center and also frequent guest. Arthur, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, to the transplant case first, to remind ourselves, this is a doctor, Dr. Ruzrock, accused of hastening death to harvest organs, charges that he took over treatment of the patient. Remember, he didn't work for the hospital. He came in with the transplant group. Court records released in California this week show a nurse told Dr. Ruzrock that she thought what he was doing in that room wasn't right. So let's start with, first of all, what's the law? Was he even allowed to be in that room?
He was not. We have a system that tries to ensure that people who sign donor cards, indicate they want to be an organ donor, they are taken care of by doctors and nurses who don't care one way or another about that. In other words, the care of the patient is done by a team or individuals that are completely separate by law and by policy from those who get involved in organ donation.
Right, so there's a firewall.
There's a firewall, and literally we call it the dead donor rule. You don't get into cadaver organ donation until the patient is pronounced dead. And in fact, the person who pronounces you, not only cares for you, but pronounces you, isn't on the payroll of the transplant team, doesn't have any connection there. A gigantic wall to separate care of the patient from anything about donation. And that's because, Robin, if you ask people, many of them say, I don't want to be an organ donor because if I sign that card, they won't treat me aggressively.
Right. They'll be wanting to get my organs.
Exactly. Or they'll give them to a rich person. So we've tried over the past 30 years to really build that wall.
Well, it's alleged that this doctor, the one who was there from the transplant company, again, not with the hospital, directed the hospital staff to remove 25-year-old Ruben Navarro's breathing tube. And Navarro's doctor, who came into the room after Ruzrock did, agreed. Now, her lawyer said she did nothing wrong, but what about the hospital's responsibility?
Oh, there's problems here if these allegations are true. What happened was the gentleman who was dying was taken off life support. That's why Dr. Ruzrock, the person who was going to try and harvest organs, came in. But the gentleman didn't die. His heart kept beating. At that point, the transplant people should have left the room, gotten right out of there. The doctor who was caring for him should have ordered them out of there. Instead, they allegedly and apparently began to figure out, well, how can we get this gentleman to die once he's off life support? Because if he's not on life support and he dies, his organs are going to go bad. So they shifted in an absolutely unethical way, if, again, the allegations are true, from managing the dying of this patient to making the obtaining of organs the priority, not the care of the patient.
Well, in fact, it's further alleged by nurses who were in the room that he then, the doctor then, the harvesting doctor then, injected the patient with all sorts of material to try to hasten his death.
Right, and we call that in the ethics trade, there's a very technical way to analyze that. It's called, holy cripes, you're kidding me. You cannot do anything to accelerate death in trying to get organs.
Well, you know, this type of donation, when it's done correctly, is called donation after cardiac death, where a brain-dead patient taken off life support, organs are harvested, as you said, within 30 minutes after the heart stops, so the organs are still usable. How chilling is this on organ donation?
It really can bother people. I think my great fear is not only did they do something completely wrong if they accelerated this patient's death, they frighten people this way. You get attention to this story, and you can kind of hear donor cards getting ripped up from one end of the country to the other. People say, well, if that's how they're going to deal with it, I don't want to be that.
Well, on the other hand, we want to take a look at this other case, which is sort of someone coming to life. It concerns a 38-year-old man who had been in a coma since he was mugged 6 years ago, a near coma. Doctors at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio implanted electrodes in his brain. Mm-hmm. He's been able to talk, eat, even move a little.
They basically broke him out of what's come to be known as a minimally conscious state. Now, that's not to be confused with permanent vegetative state, the classic example of that recently.
Make the distinction. Yeah, make the distinction.
Terry Schiavo's brain basically had no organized activity except in the thermostat of her brain, the cerebellum. This gentleman, who they sort of kick-started back into consciousness, he had some signals going on in his brain, but they were scrambled. Think of it like a TV set. This guy was had, if you will, a rolling picture. You could see something was going on there, but it didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
He wasn't responsive.
Terry
Schiavo was, the set was basically running on snow. Mm-hmm.
But he was fed by a tube. He had slight eye-finger movements. But there are thousands of these kinds of patients, I would guess, across the country from car accidents.
And I will tell you honestly, previously, a lot of people had said, look, even at that level, not Terry Schiavo, but just at this minimally conscious state, if they're not responding after a year, you can start thinking about removing their life support.
Well, so what does this mean for the thousands of relatives who may be asking themselves, did I pull the plug too early?
Too soon. I think those people should rest easy because, as happens sometimes in medicine, nothing could have been done 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 7 years ago. Nothing would have happened that would have helped these people. We just didn't have the technology. We'll have to see whether this guy who was, if you will, kick-started, maintains consciousness. But there are advances. We do learn to do things in medicine that we couldn't do 5 or 10 years ago. So you can't guilt yourself by the standards of today, so to speak. You got to go back and say, I did the right thing at the time. No one could have anticipated anything like that. But now we do have a problem. Here it looks like some of these minimally conscious people, we're going to have to ask the question, can we legitimately say that's enough? Or even if relatives say that's it, I don't want them to stay like that, is the doctor going to honor that?
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, too, that there might be some families. The mother of this patient is delighted because her son can now say mommy and daddy.
Right.
But there might be families who say, you know, I don't want to jumpstart my family member to live that quality life.
Right. Severely impaired. And remember, Robin, everybody does have the right to write down on a piece of paper, a living will, whether they do or don't want this. I don't want anybody to go away thinking this guy was jump-started back to normality. He's there, but he's still severely impaired. Some people would pick that, some wouldn't. I think the best guidance we can give on that is let your loved ones know what your wishes would be, and it's even better if you write it down.
Yeah. Arthur Kaplan, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center, and as always, Arthur, as technology comes along, it just keeps constantly raising questions.
Well, it's good for my business.
And it's complicated for everyone else. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, before we go today, former lead singer of the Cranberries, Dolores O'Riordan, has kind of come out of hiding. She's got a new life, a new solo CD. We'll give it a listen. Thank you. A man walks into a bar. Ouch! Get it? Well, of course you do, unless you're under the age of 2. But is it possible that if you don't get it, you may be over the age of, say, 82? You may be too old. A recent survey conducted at Washington University in St. Louis found that adults over the age of 65 were not as good as undergrad students at basic joke comprehension. Why? Well, according to the researchers, older people were more likely to have damaged frontal lobes in their brains and more difficulty concentrating on the joke, making them miss the punchline. The researchers hope to use the study to learn more about cognition in the elderly, but they say it's important in and of itself because laughter's been proven to increase physical and psychological health. Well, in the meantime, what do those on the senior comedy circuit, yes, there is such a thing, think about all of this? 82-year-old Jerry Novak and his partner, Ginny Weiss, perform for retirement communities in the St. Louis area as the duo Comedy to Go, and Jerry joins us now. Welcome.
Hello there.
Your thoughts on the study?
I thought it was pretty good, a little too technical for me. I've done all the nursing homes and the retirement homes within 100 miles of St. Louis, and I think I've learned a little bit about how older people react to jokes.
Do you feel the study's conclusions were accurate?
Fairly accurate. I've learned that you've got to talk slower to the older people, and you've got to use a lot of one-liners. Don't give them a long story. And sometimes, even after you give the punchline, the reaction, there's a little delay in the reaction, 1 or 2 seconds.
Huh. The researchers said that they used a joke and story completion test that was developed in 1983, where you begin a joke stem, I guess you professionals call it, and then there are 4 endings to choose from, and only one really is the right one. Mm-hmm. I have one of them right here, or at least a couple of the answers, so let me try this on you, okay?
Okay.
A businessman is riding the subway after a hard day at the office. A young man sits down next to him and says, "Call me a doctor, call me a doctor." The businessman asks, "What's the matter? Are you sick?" Okay, here are the 2 endings to choose from. "Yes, I am sick. I feel a little weak. Please help me." Or, "No, I just graduated from medical school." Pum-pum.
Give me that last one.
Well, see, now they seem pretty easy, but what are you saying? Are you saying that some of your, you know, the people in an older audience, it may take them a second?
Yes, they've got to think about it. They've got to have visual effects to go with it. Like, you've got to walk around or have facial expressions like I do. And they understand the joke a little better that way.
Huh. Well, you know, Jerry, it's funny. We understand that apparently the senior circuit for comedy is huge now. Young comics like Sarah Silverman going to retirement communities in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think's going on? I mean, if the researchers are saying that the elderly aren't getting it, it sounds like they're turning out in droves for people like you.
I think the older audience has been neglected. The last 20 years or so, the younger comedians, the material is not based on an adult audience.
Mm.
The material and some of the words are rejected by the older people.
They want something tailored for them, and you're saying maybe tailored for them in other ways as well. Well, Jerry, you got the floor. Give us a couple of lines.
Couple of lines, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Las Vegas last week, and boy, did I stay at a great hotel, the MGM Grand. You heard about that, right?
Yeah.
What I tell you, what a hotel. The towels were so thick and fluffy. I had a hard time closing my suitcase. It worked.
Yeah.
They get that one real quick. Another one, let's see. Well, did you read about that church? They play bingo every week, and they use the profits to fight gambling. Speaking of churches.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. You know what? I didn't get that. That went right by me.
Hello?
Sorry.
Hello? Is this on? That gets a big laugh. Except here. Anyway.
Jerry, so it sounds like you're not upset about the conclusions of this study, which, you know.
There is a difference, but they enjoy humor.
Yeah. And do you agree with the other thing the researchers are saying, that it makes them healthier?
Absolutely. Like I say on the top of my postcard I mail out, laughter is medicine.
Jerry Novak, performs Comedy to Go with Ginny Weiss for the retirement homes in the St. Louis area. He's 82 years young. Jerry, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
After a quick break, the voice of the Cranberries, now a solo act, Here and Now. Here and Now. Remember back in the 90s, an 18-year-old lass from Limerick got together with a pair of brothers and a drummer and formed the band The Cranberries. A few years later, they had their first hit, Linger.
You got me wrapped around your finger. Do you have to let it linger? Do you have to? Do you have to? Do you have to let it linger?
They followed with two more super hits, Zombie and Dream, helped along by the videogenic looks and Celtic-favored wail of lead singer Dolores O'Riordan. In just a few years, the Cranberries sold 40 million records, and O'Riordan was reportedly the richest woman in Ireland. But after running the treadmill of success and producing tours and albums and eventually babies, the singer was drained, dangerously skinny, and ready to get off. So, of course, the next step was rehab and a tell-all. Well, actually, no. Dolores O'Riordan went home to attend to kids' skinned knees and to be there when her mother-in-law died. She also found a great shrink and teamed up with her husband, a rock manager. Now 4 years after leaving the Cranberries, Dolores O'Riordan has released her first solo CD, Are You Listening? And she joins us now from NPR West with more. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. That was an absolutely lovely introduction. I have to tell you, though, I spent a lot of my money now. Like all rock stars. Kids are expensive, you know.
Well, how tough was that? I mean, I can't imagine being crowned the richest woman in any country. I mean,
I totally wasn't, man. Because you know, like Enya, she's like massive. And she's no kids around now. She sold like 80 million records or something.
What a hype, man. But just to people, for people to think that, what did that do to your life?
Not really much, but I will tell you that being chased by the paparazzi when I was sick didn't help my illness, you know, and that's unfortunately part of the game that we play, us, what they call celebrities.
When you say sick, were you anorexic? You went down to, what, 90 pounds?
No, I was just completely mental. Or I wasn't mental, but the world around me was. Everybody was looking at me and there was people chasing me all the time. But having said that then, if it's weird, what you have to do is escape, and I found my escapism. Luckily, you know what I mean?
Do you mean in a beautiful family?
In a beautiful family, yeah. And I kind of went off to the forest, and a lot of the songs were reflecting what I was going through in my head at the time too, you know.
Was Human Spirit one of those songs?
Human Spirit was actually, when I was away in the forest for the last 4 years, I was kind of, I suppose, wondering what life would have been like had I not been in the Cranberries. You know, it was kind of a song about coming out and being honest and being open and not hiding anymore. Because I used to always hide. If I had anything bad in my life, I hid it from people. And that was, I was always trying to be just perfect.
Let's listen to some of Human Spirit.
Don't let
That is a soul-searching song, but you needed some help to get to the next phase, your big family help, but you also found what's called a celebrity psychoanalyst. Elton John and Kate Moss saw the same fellow. Beachy Colclough is his name. What did he do for you?
He just kind of said to me, you've made it this far, you've got here, so you're going to be okay now. So all of a sudden my life seemed like I was in this weird movie like Jacob's Ladder or something. It was like, you mean I made it to here, so that means that I'm okay? Yes, you have passed the first challenge. You're on the next level. I'm like, okay. It was totally weird. So he goes, basically he said, you're not mad. He said, your life's mad, you know? And he kind of asked me what was wrong. And he asked me, what was my skeleton? And I told him that I had skeletons. And he told me that I had to deal with them.
Yep. We'll talk about another, what seems like, you know, salvation. You married Don Burton.
What would you say to people, you know, as you retired to family life and little kids, and also your mother-in-law was sick? What would you say to that concept that domestic life is like a blunt object to the creative spirit? As some women fear.
Not for me, you see. It's different. Everybody's journey and experience in life is different. You can't compare people's journeys. For me, it was my saving grace having children, obviously. You know, it helped me to get better. It helped me to move on. It's the most beautiful, honest, real love I've ever experienced. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of something that I needed at that stage of my life. So it kind of got my head sane, and it gave me something to write about. I wrote a lot of songs then about, you know, about the kids and about life and about how much I love them. And, you know, it influences your perspective.
I understand the song Ordinary Day is dedicated to your daughter, Dakota. Is it about, you know, life as a mom?
Well, I have to be very careful here now. I have two daughters, and Ordinary Day was inspired by the birth of the second daughter, but it's a song for both my girls.
Okay.
Cause I have to be careful there,
that,
you know.
Right.
In a way, you know, when she was born, I looked at the other little girl and she was suddenly 6 years old, bang, like, where's the time going? And sometimes when you look at your daughters, you see yourself in them, and then you wonder what their journey is going to be like. And you know that no matter what you tell them you've gone through, that they're not really going to listen. They're going to have to go out there and go through all that stuff themselves. They're going to have to get their hearts broken. They're going to have ups and downs, but that is life.
Beautiful girl.
Another song, which would seem to be about a very difficult period. You were moving back and forth between Dublin and Canada to be close to your mother-in-law. She died from cancer. That song is Black Widow. There's a point in which you just really pour it all out.
And she cried.
This is not your mother. You know, it's your mother-in-law. I'm wondering what that relationship was like.
We were very close, you know. And to be honest with you, everybody that knew her, she was kind of like a mom.
How nice you had that as well as
very
your,
lucky,
your
yeah.
Family.
She was brilliant. And she taught me a lot as well, you know. Yeah.
Dolores O'Riordan, again, her new solo CD, Are You Listening? Do you see yourself reuniting with the Cranberries? I was surprised to read that you said at one point, we weren't really all that close.
Usually bands don't hang around with each other. You make music together. But you can't have like this, we make great music, plus we're best friends. Because, you know, I don't know, you might get sick of living in each other's mouths. So on tour, literally we'd sound check together and we'd do our gig. And then other than that, we didn't really hang around with each other. We all kind of went off and did our own thing. So in order to escape, you have different friends.
So do you think There will be a Cranberries get-together, or just leave it be?
You know, I don't know. I kind of think now, you know, everybody got married and then everybody had kids, you know. So I just think when the kids grow up or something like that, there might be a reunion. But I just think that the belly needs to be a bit bigger, some more grey hair, you know. Older, greyer and heavier. They're back.
The Cranberries.
Yeah, I guess, wouldn't it?
Dolores O'Riordan, we want to leave with one of the, you know, rockers you've got on your new CD, the rock and roll rockers, not, you know, the other kind. This is In the Garden. It starts out sweet and lyrical, makes quite a turn. And you've made a turn as well. I want to thank you for speaking to us about your new solo career and the CD, Are You Listening? Dolores O'Riordan, thanks very much.
Thanks, darling.
It's a panic.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join